us a little bit about yourself and your background. You know, how would someone describe Paige?
Oh gosh. Well, I think people would start with my name, which is Paige Gellett. My pronouns are she, her. I'm a community organizer here on the traditional territories of the Kwanlin Dun First Nation and Ton Kwachan Council, otherwise known as White Horse in Yukon. I'm from a lineage of very strong women. And that was very obvious to me at a very young age. I was told to, you know, I needed to take my space and to say no. And when I said no, people needed to understand that. I was told that I had a voice. And the more I grow and the more I have wisdom, the more I learn where that
no
comes from.
No buts! No education!
My involvement, I'd like to say it started when I was 7, and when my mom brought me to the picket lines in the good old Mike Harris days. Fast forward to when I was in university, and I was part of the student movement, more precisely with the Canadian Federation of Students. We were very much told and encouraged to support labor activists, because it was very much known that once we were done our education, we would be folks that would be part of that labor movement. And so it started with solidarity actions for me. Then it went to being involved in groups, notably like the women's groups, or the racialized workers groups or young workers groups, and talking about how the labor movement really affects us, and especially me in my various identities. As much as I love being involved in the labor movement, I'm very critical of the labor movement in Canada. When you look at the makeup of the labor movement, when you look at the people that are in positions of power, you always see the same people, and often they are white men. But as racialized workers, as women, as whichever identities, again, we are put on these pedestals for being the representatives of these groups. But when it comes to speaking our truth and, you know, really advocating for our needs and the request for respect and dignity in the workplace, somewhere we get into these roadblocks. So it's really nice to see now, as much as I'm critical, I have to acknowledge that the labor movement itself is recognizing, and many unions are recognizing this gap, right, of who's in power and who are the activists on the ground. But again, we have to push and to do more. And you asked, what does change look like? Often it looks like people who are in these positions of power of letting go of that power. That's the hardest one, right? When people are willing to be educated but don't want to let go of their positions of power, at the end of the day, what work and what change are you really doing? You have to start by being willing, right? You have to start by with the recognition and saying, okay, I'm willing to see change, and then recognizing your limitations. So able, if I'm somebody in a position of power, what am I able to do? Versus if I'm somebody who's more on the ground, I can't necessarily change policies because I don't have that power. What are other ways that you can do within your limitations to change the status quo?
So what about everyday life? How can people, you know, practice anti-oppression, anti-racism in their own lives?
I think whenever I get that question, I stop saying educate yourself, because I feel like there's more that you can do than educate yourself. I feel like educating yourself is so 2014. You should have educated yourself a long time ago, and it shouldn't require one of us to die or something so traumatic to happen for you to educate yourself. So I won't say educate yourself. Instead, I will say being willing and able and committed to change. I think the COVID perspective has brought a lot of reflection for people. I mean, look how fast we were able to change for COVID. At some point I started laughing because I was like, hey, we're now like the most socialist country with COVID. Like suddenly everybody is seen as essential workers and we're supporting them, and the CERB is out, you know, like we're really out there supporting each other. And you know, when we make things our priority, change can happen, and change can happen quite rapidly. And so for anybody who wants to get involved in the anti-racist movement and says, I don't know how, I don't know why, I'd say think of COVID. And ask yourself, are you really willing and able and ready to make it your priority? Then if so, you can make that change and you can make it within a couple months.
I'd be curious to hear more about global solidarity. So on the work to build more anti-racist communities, what does that look like to you?
I think it's important to know, in French we say notre point de départ, know where we start from, know the history, know the struggles that have happened and that continue to happen. Whether these struggles have different faces and different names, there's a root. And when you know the root cause, you're able to name it, you're able to dismantle it. In terms of, you know, connections or solidarity, it starts with, you know, grassroots work. You know, it's always, I find in my experiences, it's always people who are on the ground and people whose lived experiences, are often forgotten are the people who need the highest the loudest megaphone, because we need to hear it from them, and we need to support them however we can. I think also we need to make a connection between, you know, the anti-racist work, and the other, work that has happened before the term anti-racist became hot and in fashion. So I'm talking about, you know, like the anti-capitalist movement. I'm talking about the anti-homophobia, anti-transphobia movement, all the movements that have done work on accessibility for people. We can't forget them. Just because we're not talking about them, just because the policies have been made and certain wins have been won, we can't forget them and need to recognize that we wouldn't be where we are today without their work, without their solidarity, without all the sacrifices that they've made. And so I guess that comment is kind of saying, you know, we need to engage, but also pay respect to our elders who have come before us, who have put themselves in the forefront in times that were probably not the best, in times that were very precarious. And we need to make sure that we continue to tell their stories when we do work for our futures.
Does gender play into your experience of being Black in Canada?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. You know, even when I'm talking about the change in leadership roles, we have to recognize that, you know, right now, white men are very much the focus. And I think the feminist movement has done a really good job in making sure that women get into positions of power. We see a lot of conferences for women. We see a lot of dialogue for women in leadership. But those conferences and dialogues have been very exclusionary, right? They haven't included Black women, and more specifically, they haven't included trans women and racialized and Black trans women. And so, of course, gender plays a huge role when we're talking about change. It's also being willing and able to and committed to making sure that when we're talking about space for people, we mean every person.
Mm-hmm. And did that impact your relationship with feminism?
Oh gosh, I remember when I was a student, I mean, I even got a tattoo that says feminist. Like, I was so proud of my feminism. And it wasn't until I moved to Toronto and, you know, Black Lives Matter Toronto started, like I said, bumping, that I was like, oh, wait a second. My feminism was actually very exclusionary of my people, and not just my people as Black people, but also trans people, Black people with disabilities, Black Muslim people. And so I had to rethink of what feminism looks like for me, and that was hard. Especially when you have a tattoo, that was hard. It was a moment of self-reflection. And, you know, when I talk about letting go of your power, of your privilege, and being willing and able and committed for change, that was that moment for me where I was like, oh my gosh, am I really associated to this movement, or am I associated to more of the Black feminist movement? What does my feminism look like? Who does my feminism involve?
And then you move to White Horse. Mm-hmm. Can you tell me a little bit more about living up north and the connection between your identity, your community, and place?
The fact that I live in White Horse is quite surprising. I went there to search for a community that I didn't necessarily have in Toronto. So as much as I had Black community in Toronto, Toronto's a busy city, which means that we were always busy. We were always rushing. There was always something going on. And I needed space to breathe and to acknowledge who's around me. And that's what I found in White Horse. I actually had a conversation with a friend of mine recently where we talked about as racialized people, especially in Canada, we're not encouraged to embrace winter or embrace the outdoors, which is fascinating because often we are people who are outdoorsy people. We are people like in, you know, we talked about generations who were farmers, who did touch and grow earth, who know spices, who were outdoors, who had survival. And it's fascinating how colonization takes these things from us. And so for me, being outdoors was kind of a way of decolonizing my mind frame, decolonizing my education around Canada. I always follow Instagram accounts that are like being outdoors while Black, skiing while Black, and you know, these, or even racialized voices doing outdoor things, because for me it's exciting. We have different fears. We, you know, sometimes our fears, yes, especially here in Yukon, our fears are grizzly bears, and, you know, the wolves and whatnot, but our fears is also being on people, like on a terrain where people might not see us belonging. You know, we have that fear, or at least I do. I have that fear of going camping somewhere and, you know, having to confront racism.
So what motivates you to keep going?
I'm someone who's very positive, and I like to see the future. And for me, the future is bright because we are having these conversations. This summer, we co-created our group, which is Northern Voices Rising. And it started with the very unfortunate death of George Floyd and Regis Korchinski Paquette. And we decided to do a rally. So one rally that we did in White Horse and in Dawson City. In White Horse, we had over 900 people show up on the first day that people were able to go camping. And that says a lot. I had never seen so many people come out in support of racialized voices, and especially of Black and Indigenous voices. And from there we said, well, obviously if people are willing and able to come out and rally, we can do more work. We can do that change that we want to see.